going to work this time. So I'm here. Well, I have this projector in my face. I'm Stephanie Ryan. I'm working at HP Labs in Palo Alto. And I'm here to describe the work we've been doing for over a year and a half now, trying to port Linux to IS64. In this talk, I'm trying to give you more technical details about the port itself and IS64 in the first part. Now that more information has been disclosed, we can talk more freely about what's there. And being in Ottawa, I thought that may be appropriate to put both languages, French and English, but don't be afraid, I'm going to stop at the first page. Because if it's too technical, then you're in trouble. Okay, so basically I have something like three or four parts in my talk, and I'm going to finish with a demo. And the first part, I'm going to give you an overview of what IS64 is with some of the new features that you don't find in other processors. And each time I try to give an example, a code example, so that you can really feel what it is. Then I describe a little bit about what the goal of this port is and how we are working with it. We're working on it given that no hardware is yet available. And since at the time we started, clearly there was no hardware. Even today, we're still waiting for the hardware. Anyway, so that's another issue. I describe the kernel work and then also the user work, because the kernel by itself is useless. So you need the whole stuff to get a running system. And then I'll finish with the demo. As a quick survey, how many of you have heard of IS64 before? And how many of you have downloaded the instruction set from the website since it's been disclosed since May 26th? Okay. So not many of you. So what is IS64? It's the next generation CPU, high performance high-end CPU from Intel and also from HP. It's been designed jointly by Intel and HP, even though at the end you're going to see the Intel logo probably on it. But most of the technology about this chip is coming from HP and HP Labs. Initially, it's not a RISC processor, it's not a CISC processor, it's not a VLIW processor. It builds on top of those to introduce a new paradigm which they call EPIC, for explicit parallel instruction set computing. And it may look like a marketing stuff, but I'll describe later what it really means. And IS64 is the code name for the architecture. The first implementation of this chip is going to be the Merced chip. Then it's going to be followed probably the year after by the McKinley chip, which is slated to be much faster. And then later, maybe in 2002, there is Deerfield and Madison, the next two chips. And according to the schedule, the first machines with the Merced processor in them are going to appear sometimes next year. So what is EPIC? EPIC is the fact that it's the idea that in order to get better performance, you want to expose the instruction level parallelism to the user, i.e. the compiler. So it's based on the idea that the compiler is closer from the real program, so it can figure out what the program is really trying to do. And by knowing this, it can make better optimizations. And when you're down on the chip and trying to figure out, oh, can I really move this instruction and stuff, what the program is really doing. So by pushing this up to the compiler, you hope to get better performance and better optimization opportunities. That's what is done here. So, and then the CPU is basically, you hope it's simpler hardware and can execute much faster. So the parallelism is presented to the CPU by grouping instruction into bundles. Each bundle is 128-bit wide, and it contains three instructions which are executed in parallel. Besides that, each bundle has what is called a template field, which you see on the right-hand side here, which tells basically what are the execution units that are needed to execute those three instructions. And M being that's a memory operation, I an integer operation, B a branch instruction, or F a floating point operation. The parallelism can span more than one bundle. So you can have like six or seven instructions can be executed in parallel. Now, you need a way to express synchronization, because you may have dependencies on one instruction is reading a register and the other one before it's writing it and stuff like that. So you need to express synchronization, and that's done with the stop bit that is also encoded in this template field. I'll give you an example in the next slide. Beside of that, it has a lot of resources, like 128 integer registers, floating point registers, and it has also lots of execution units. So that's the basic of how the instructions are grouped. Now, it has some very nice features, which I'm going to give you an overview now. Not all of them, but a selected set of them. So IS64 introduces the notion of predication. What is predication? It's the idea that in order to reduce the branching cost and the misprediction associated with that, you want to do something like predicate each instruction, and when the predicate is evaluated to false, you simply don't execute the instruction, i.e. it's the equivalent of on PA, if you're familiar with PA, the nullification of the instruction. Basically, it's just a no-op that you execute here. So each time, I try to give an example so that you really see what it means. Here I have a C statement that reading if R1 equals 0, then R2 receives R4 plus R5, otherwise it's R3, R6, and plus 1. So this code can be translated in IS64 assembler like this. You do a compare if equal, and you have two predicate registers, P1 and P2. You compare R1 with R0, R0 is constant and returns 0. Okay, so you say if R1 equals 0, then P1 is going to receive true, and P2 the opposite, which is false. And then on the next two instructions, they are predicated instructions, you see that on the left-hand side. And if P1 is true, then the first I is going to be executed, and the second one is not, and the opposite in case P2 is true. The thing is to notice that the two adds are in the same bundle, so they are executed in parallel. But that's okay in this case, because only one of the two predicates can be true. So what you see here is that you can execute an if, then else, with no branches, very efficiently. The semicolon here is to express the synchronization, because here you can't really execute the compare in parallel with the adds, because you need the result of the compare to figure out which add to execute. So that's expressed here with the semicolon, because basically you have a read after write dependency on the predicate registers. So that's one feature of IS64. The other one that is maybe more difficult to understand is the control speculation. Oftentimes, compilers try to be smart and say they want to hide the memory access latency by trying to move loads before they're really used so that the time to access memory is more or less hidden in the execution path. The problem with that is that it's very difficult, because it may be dangerous, because if you move it too far, you may be generating an exception or something on the load. And if you ever get an exception where you don't expect it, you don't know what to do. So that sometimes limits the ability of the compiler to do very nice optimizations. So on IS64, they introduce what is called control speculation, where you have a mechanism by which you can safely move loads away from the point where they're used. And if something goes wrong, you don't get the trap or the exception. Instead, there is a flag that is set somewhere that says, oh, your load failed. And when it's when you reach the point where you actually need the result of the load, you can simply check, and if the operation succeeded, then you just fall through. The data is already there. And if it fails, then you just go to some recovery code or you just retry the load. So, let me get a drink here. So, the way to keep track of the success or failure of the operation is via something called a NAT bit, which is another thing bit, which is like a 65th bit of every register. Every register is 64 bit wide, the integer registers, but they're really a 65th bit, which encodes the thing that the operation on the load succeeded or failed. And then later you can come in the code and check did the operation succeed or not by just checking this bit. You can do that on integer registers and also on floating point registers. On floating point, instead of using a NAT bit, they use a NAT value, the special value that is encoded in the register. So at the bottom, let me give you an example. You have this code where you have a conditional branch, and it's followed by a load, and R1 is the target of the load. And then the next instruction, you just use the result of the load. So on the second column, you see cycles. So if you suppose that there is a two-cycle memory access latency, you see that the add execute at cycle number 3. So you stall between the load and the add. So one way to move that, to avoid the stall, you just do a speculative load on the same instruction on R1. So you move it before the branch, before even knowing you're going to use it. Okay? And if, for instance, the address in R5 points to an unmapped memory, instead of getting the exception, the R1 register is going to have its NAT bit set, but you're going to continue execution. Okay? So now when P1 is false, you just don't execute the branch and you get to this check instruction. The check instruction is simply looking at the NAT bit, and if it's set, you say, oh, I need to jump to some recovery code. If it's not set, then you just fall through and you execute the add instruction, and you see here the effect on the cycles. So basically you don't stall on the load and the add is executed right after the branch. So that's called control speculation. The other thing that has is called data speculation, where this time you're trying to make sure that when you move a load ahead of time, you're not conflicting with a store that might happen after the load, with something like an alias address. You have a store and a load, but you don't know if they're pointing to the same address. So usually it's difficult to tell. So what this does is you move the load before the store, and you turn it into an advanced load. And what it does is it has a table, in the CPU has a table inside, an internal table, and it keeps track of this register is a target of a load of this of that many bytes at this address. And then on every store, you check the table. And if the store happens to conflict with the load, you just invalidate the entry in the table. And when you reach the point where you actually need the data, just like we had the check.s, you have a check.a that simply looks up the table and see, is the content of R1 in the example still valid, or is it stale information? And just like the control speculation, you can just retry or just fall through and say there was an error. So that's data speculation. And you can combine the two by having speculative advanced loads as well. So it's hard to think about it, but well, if it's there, there is a good reason, right? So the other nice thing about this that has been disclosed recently is this register stack engine, RSE. The idea is to avoid having to do the caller callee save stuff on the procedure calls. So you avoid register, fill, and spill each time you call a procedure. So if you look at it, you say, oh, but that's like, I think it's Spark or something like register Windows. But here it's the next generation thing where the window is not fixed in size and it can vary. And the best thing is to give, let's look at the example here to try and understand what's going on. Here at the top, you have you're in function A, and that's the current stack frame of function A. And the register that it uses, out of the 128 registers, the first 32 are called fixed registers. They're not part of this game. And from 32 to 128, they are used in this procedure calling mechanism. They're called stack registers. So in this case, the function A has something like 20 registers local, which can be broken down into the input parameter that it received, the locals that it uses for its own purpose inside, and then the outputs which are used to call other functions. Now, let's see what happens when you, from A, you call B. So you execute a branch.call, and basically this B has 5 parameters in this case. So what happens is that the stack is virtually moved forward, and now it has a size of 5. And notice that 32 moved from the left corner to this new location. So it's a renaming scheme that's going on. Okay? And when you enter B, B has 4 locals. So the alloc instruction simply resizes the register window, and now you have 9 registers. What's interesting is what's going on the other ones, the one that you left behind. They are still live in the registers, but behind your back, or you can control that, there is this register stack engine that is going to asynchronously to your execution spill the dirty register onto the memory backing store for you. And when you come back, they're going to be restored as needed. So the stack engine operates in various modes, where it's lazy or eager, depending on when you want to do spill automatically and things like that. So basically, you have to decouple the physical register set from this logical one.
Doesn't that make context switching extremely expensive?
Why? That's done automatically on your back.
Well, but whether it's done automatically or not, it's still going to take a lot of time to move the data, right, isn't it?
Well,
that's almost 10K of data.
Well, I can come back to that later. Another thing that has been disclosed for a long time now is this register rotation scheme. That's another rotation scheme, not to be confused with the procedure calling one. It's used for loop unrolling, and the nice thing about it is that you can unroll loops with no code expansion, because that's the trade-off, the classical trade-off. You say, oh, I want to unroll my loop, but well, my loop doubles in size. So this nice feature allows you to unroll the loops with no expansion. And you can rotate registers. You can rotate any kind of registers, integer, floating point, and even predicate registers. So the thing about the code expansion is that the prologue and the epilogue of the loop are embedded into the body of the loop also. So that's another nice feature. That's why you need the predicate register. So basically, you have the view of a pipeline. And at the beginning of the loop, you need to fill the pipeline. When it's in a good state, and you just do the body of the loop. And at the end of the loop, you drain the pipeline. And I think I'm going to give you an example later of a pipeline in the loop. Oops. So now that's about what I wanted to present about the IS64 architecture. I think you can find more information on the instruction set. Manually, it's quite big and it has lots of stuff. Now the question is, well, why do you want to do this port? Well, we think that in order for Linux to be taken seriously. You have to have the port just like you're going to get any other big OSs at launch date. You're going to have HP UX, Solaris, Windows 64, and all those things are going to be available. So why would the Linux people pay the price of waiting? Oh no, we have to wait maybe 6 months or a year before getting the port done. And it's not easy to do a port of to Linux of IS64. It's quite a complex architecture, so it takes time to do that. So we started this back in February 98, and we think we'll be able to deliver on time sometime next year, probably. So is there a problem with GPL? No, because what we're doing is we're not doing a distribution. We're keeping the patches. We're doing diffs out of the standard official distribution or kernel and things like that. So we give you the 2.2.9 or something, and then we give you a patch to it that you apply, and you get the IS64 port. And the goal, of course, is to release that all the code base as soon as the NDAs are lifted, so probably when the machines become available next year. Okay, so what was the original goal on this thing? Well, the first, I would say, modest goal was to get a self-hosted system, at least, so that early developers could come on board and try to put more applications and things like that. And given the progress we've made so far, I think we revised our goal somehow around February, and now we're looking into a full CD installation, just like the guy from the Psion before. So we're looking at a full CD that you plug in, just like your Red Hat CD-ROM, with most of the standard packages there. And it has to be, of course, fully functional. And we're trying now to optimize for performance. It means for the compiler, the libraries, and all that stuff. And it's going to have SMP support and also the x86 binary compatibility. Okay. So what do you need to do in order to port Linux to IS64 to any other platform? Is you need more than just the kernel, of course. And I want to insist on that. The kernel is nice, but the kernel alone is completely useless. It's a nice technical thing. So basically, in our case, we needed a platform simulator, because that's one of the interesting part of this project, is that we don't have the hardware. I'm not sure it's been done before on Linux, is that we have to worry about all the NDAs and stuff like that, but also we don't even have the hardware. Then you need to work on the kernel, but I would say even before working on the kernel, you need to get a compiler and the tool chain, because there is nothing you can do before that. So the kernel is needed, clearly the GCC is needed, and all the tool chain. Then the next step is to get the C and math libraries, at least, and then you can start porting applications and run them on top of the kernel. And we've broken down this into what are really required and the other, where I want and it would be nice to have, like the Linux x86 and things like that. I've added VI because I like VI. And David prefers the Emacs, okay. So at least we are sure that you get both the first time. So who is working on that? I think clearly HP Labs is working on that. I've been working since February 98. And we've produced a tool chain, a GCC, GCS-based tool chain. We've been working on the kernel architecture, most of the kernel subsystems, and we actually implemented that stuff, not just design and all that. CERN and Jess, who is here, has been working on the user level libraries, basically the GNU/Libc and math library. And we have a high ranking Linux developer who wants to remain anonymous at this point still. So he's there mostly for development and validation of the port. And we've been recently involved into collaboration with the other partners listed here, like Cygnus, Intel, SGI, and VA Linux System, to deliver the best possible port on day one. And Cygnus is there, that's good, so that they can, we can offload the work on GCC onto them because they're more expert. And our goal is not to produce a GCC compiler, it's to produce a system. They're more looking into producing a good tool chain. And they have officially announced that they've contracted with Intel to produce a compiler for IE64. Okay, so who are they? It's crazy what you can do with GIMP these days. So I'm not working in Hawaii, but so you have the people from CERN here, Jess is here, and you have Dan Pobsvery, Fons, Christian, and Ignacio, and ourselves in the back. Yeah, to the, our Swiss friends. So the tool chain. So clearly, Linux depends on GNU-C. What I mean, GNU-C is not necessarily GCC. It's the GNU-C with its extensions, like you know all the extensions that they have, like the initialization of structure, all the ASM, the Inlight, and all that stuff. The kernel needs that, but also the C library clearly needs all those features. So it's not a, there is no question. You can't just take, let's see, HP's compiler or SGI or whatever compiler and go straight to the kernel. You won't do that very cleanly. You can do it, but it's going to take quite some time. So we clearly needed a GNU-C. So the obvious candidate was the EGCS compiler. So our goal was to produce a system, not a compiler. So instead of trying to put in all the EPIC optimization and stuff like that, we focus on to producing a functional backend. Basically, it produces correct code, but not optimized. It doesn't use the speculation, the rotation, and all that stuff. But it produces correct code, good enough to compile the kernel, the C libraries, and actually runs the programs. The compiler by itself is not enough. You need the linker and the assembler and all of that. So we did that too. And so we have the GAS package, basically, with the assembler, the linker, and all the goodies like NM, size, and all that stuff. The programming model is LP64, which means that longs and pointers are 64-bit, and integers are still 32-bit. It's very, it's the model that is used by other 64-bit Unixes like HPUX, and I think Linux Alpha is also using this. So it's a fairly common model. The binary format is ELF64, no surprise here, and with the IE64 extension added to it. And we simply hope that when better compilers are available, we can simply recompile and get better performance. We're looking at into moving forward in the port, not just stuck here. So the simulator, well, there is, of course, no public domain simulator, right? So we use an HP internal instruction set simulator. What does it mean? It means that it simulates the instruction set only, so the full instruction set of the CPU. It doesn't simulate at the gate level. It doesn't simulate the whole platform. So you have no PCI emulation, no BIOS emulation, no SCSI and all that. It's concentrated on the CPU. And it does, it's optimized for accuracy, not performance. So it can be slow, but it simulates accurately. If there is a bit field that is reserved in registers and you try to touch it, you're going to get a fault. It's very accurate. And it has a nice feature, which is user or system mode simulation. In user mode, basically, you have the non-privileged instruction. And it's very handy because you can run user-level application, and when you get to a system call, you trap to the simulator, and then you use the host OS to basically do the mapping of the IE64 system call into the IE42 system call. So this way you can run user-level application with no kernel. And in the other mode, you get the full instruction set so that, and also the VM and all of the TLBs and all of that simulated, so you can actually bring up the OS and then the applications on top. So the work we did was to port this emulator from HPUX to Linux x86. So the good thing about that is that we had the one-to-one mapping for system calls, emulation. So when you had the iOS control on a Linux application, you could directly map it to the IF32 underneath. You had to do, of course, some bit of marshalling of 64 to 32 back and forth. And it was also good because we, at that point, we had the whole development environment hosted on the Linux x86, like on my laptop, for instance. We could do that. Now, the bad thing about the simulator is that it didn't have any I/O device emulation, so we have had to hack a few things to get access to a disk, a console, and Ethernet also. So basically, we are using a disk on your file system to simulate a disk image. And we're using an Xterm as a serial console, and we're using an actual Ethernet interface on the host, and we do some raw socket access on that. So for the kernel, the goal was to minimize the modification to the machine-independent part. I think we quite succeeded so far, because I think the modification of the machine-independent is like less than 10 or 10 lines or something. So we focus our attention into the Arch and include directories. And basically, we have had to populate those two directories with the stuff expected by the machine independent part. And the good thing about this approach, too, is that we've been able to follow the kernel development, because the patch would apply very easily because it was very localized. So we started with 2.1.26. And now we are at 2.3.9, I think since the last week or 2 weeks ago. And instead of trying to put the whole thing, what we did, I think it's the Psion person did that too, is that you do incremental bring up by you manage to get to start kernel, and then you command everything out into this function, and then you say, okay, let's do the first one, the second one, so you can get the printf, the banner of the kernel, then you get the BOGO MIP, then you get the cache initialized, the memory cache, and all that, very step by step. So some of the attributes of the kernel are, it's of course 64-bit, and it's using Little Endian as the byte ordering. And the page size so far is set to 8K, but it's possible that it's going to grow maybe to 16K pages. And the virtual address space for a process is about 43 bits, so it's about 8 terabyte worth of space. And of course, to hook up this kernel to the simulator, we have had to develop special device drivers for a disk, for console, and for Ethernet. And the nice thing about this is that for the SimSCSI, for instance, it allowed us to exercise the whole SCSI stack. So we exercised a lot of code. All three drivers are interrupt-driven, so you exercise that code too. The SimSCSI is just doing read and write you trap to the simulator by saying read or write at this offset for that many bytes. The sim serial is just get char and put char on the Xterm. And the sim Ethernet is reading and writing raw frames. And the nice thing about that one is that if you combine this with a block packet filter plus putting the actual interface on the host in promiscuous mode, you can get your own IP address on the simulated kernel. And that's what we did. So we could R-log in into the simulated machine or ping in and out also with no contention with the actual IP address of the host. So what's the status on the kernel? Well, we have completed most of the key subsystems. So we have the process subsystem, we have the VM, you can swap and all that. We have the signal subsystem running. We have the network, clearly, even though it's not using an actual device driver, but most of the checksumming and all of that is present. We have the ptrace support also. So you can peek and poke, you can do the usual stuff, the system called tracing and all of that. And we've put some optimizations in. Well, we didn't spend that much time, but at least some obvious candidates are very easy. We try to put try to use some of the features I described earlier, and I'm going to show you that in the next slide. What's still left to do is the SMP support, clearly, the x86 support, because clearly some people really care about that. They want to be able to run their old x86 binaries. And the platform dependent support, like the bootloader and the PCI and whatever you need on this machine. The kernel modules still need to be addressed. And of course, you need the second pass and do all the possible performance tuning that you have to do. So as an example of how you can use IS64 advanced feature in the kernel, but you can use it also outside. But here I give you an example inside the kernel. I want to show you string length user. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this function. It's basically a string length in the kernel, but it has to be very careful because it's trying to measure the length of a string that is coming from user space. So it has to be careful not to go over and touch a page that is not mapped. So normally in the Linux kernel, what you do is they use some kind of an optimistic scheme where they touch, and if they fall, they go to an exception table. They say, oh, they look up in the table. I say, oh, that's an exception that was in string length. So when I get the exception in string length, I really need to jump back later in the code in string length and return some error code. So one way to do that in IS64 is to use, of course, control speculation, where you say, well, I'm not going to go out. I just stay on my code, and if something goes wrong, I just use the speculation for that. And this is combined here with rotation. There is register rotation going on, and there is parallel compares going on. You see also that you're basically loading 16 bytes at a time. This is a two-cycle loop, and it's reading 16 bytes and looking for a zero in 16 bytes in two cycles. So the way to look at it is to, let me first explain. So you have a pipeline. You have basically in your mind, you need to have two pipelines of depth two, the red one and the yellow one. Okay? So because you want to load 16 bytes, but you have only load 8, so you do two loads in a row in parallel. And basically in the first phase here, you speculatively load 2 8 bytes in each of the two pipelines, in R32 and R44, which are the entry points of the two pipelines. Okay, and then the next two instructions are called compute zero index, which is looking for byte zero in an 8-byte quantity here. So they're executed on the previously loaded registers here, 33 and 35. And if the zero byte is found, R14 or R15 are set with the index in the byte where the zero byte is. Otherwise, R14 or R15 are loaded with 8, meaning not found. Then in the next group of instruction, you do the comparison. They say, did I find the zero byte in any of the two compares? And those two compares are run in parallel. And the outcome is that if ever P6 is true, it means that we didn't find it. So we need to loop back again and look for a next 16 bytes. But the magic happens when you loop back. This is a while loop. When you loop back to the label at the top, the register rotation happens. And basically, the content of R32 is now in R33. So you see, everything drops down one level. So when you go back at the top, you're going to fill in two new values in 32 and 44. But the values that you loaded two cycles ago are now in 33 and 45. And you can just compare them with no contention. So that's the magic. So here you hide the latency of two cycles on memory access. The other thing too that is interesting is what happens when you fault on the load 8, speculative load. Basically, if any of the two load 8s fail, the NAT bit of 32 or 34 are going to be set. But you're not going to go to any exception table, and you just stay in line. And when you do, you do one loop again, and when you're trying to touch the content of 33 and 35, which have now been moved, they also have their NAT bit set, because when you rotate also the NAT bit. So if something went wrong, when you check the compute zero index on R33, it has its NAT bit set. So the result is going to be propagated to R14 also. So R14 is going to have this the NAT bit set. And eventually, when you reach the compare, if you try to compare registers that have their NAT bit set, the predicate register is going to be set to false, and you fall out of the loop. It is six or eight lines. You see a lot of the mechanism of IS64 used together here. And you can see that it can be quite powerful. Of course, after you fall out of the loop, you need to do the disambiguation of saying, was it in the first 8 byte or the next 8 byte that you found the zero? But it's not no big deal. So back to user level. While we were making progress on the kernel, CERN decided to join our effort, and they chose to go with the C library and the math library. So they worked pretty intensively for 3 weeks, and in 3 weeks we got a first port, generic port, of course, no optimization, but still, once you get the C library, you get all the header files and stuff, and you can start compiling real world applications. So that's what we did. Of course, the first part was statically linked libraries. As soon as we got the C library from CERN, I think, started playing with compiling real applications, because before that, we were using our own developed applications with no libc. We had developed a micro libc, and out of this micro libc, we did a small, we rewrote LS, CP, a small shell, and all of that to help us bring up the system and test it, because the kernel by itself, well. So once we got the libc, things got better and got worse also, because now the system started to be slower. Of course, because the libc is huge, and you do a call into this gigantic thing, it takes forever. But at least we can recompile real program, like the full login sequence. Like, what I did is took the Red Hat 6 source distribution, I took the RPM, and I just recompiled them. So that's how we got the init out of the system 5 to something, the min-get TTY, and a few shells. Like, I think we first got Ash. Yeah. And then, because this one was simpler, and then KSH, Bash, and TCSH. We got first the VI, of course. Vim was the first one. It's the standard one with the Red Hat, I think. Then we got the file util, shells util, text utils, and also the basic of the networking, like ifconfig, netstat, route, ping, and those sorts of things. So what's left to do at the user level? Well, clearly, lots of optimizations are possible in the, like the string compare, memcopy, and all of that. And also the dynamic loader is required, and I think it's people at CERN are working on that now. And of course, we also need to look into porting more applications, and basically to get a full distribution, you need all the other ones, like X3, toolkit, a desktop thing like GNOME, you need a web browser, you need GDB, of course, and you need other languages, plus whatever applications you like or you use every day that you would like to see. The important bullet at the bottom I want to stress because it's very annoying when you look at those packages and you compile them and then you get an illegal unaligned access trap or something like that because they're not 64-bit clean. And surprisingly enough, some of the basic packages are still not 64-bit clean. I give you two examples. Ping is not 64-bit clean. The basic ping that is out of Netkit or something is not 64-bit clean, and it's far from being 64-bit clean. But you can argue, well, but no, it's working on alpha. Well, yes, it is, because it's relying on the underlying trap handling and the emulation. But this program is bad, because it's hard coding data structure sizes, and it's casting the payload of the ping packet into a struct time val or something with no checks. It's just going straight. Another program that was not 64-bit clean until 2 weeks ago is RPM. RPM 301 was not. It was a stupid cast of time t. They thought that time t was still 32-bit always, but it's 64-bit on LP64. So when you cast, you have a problem. Those sorts of things. So please, if you maintain a package, make sure that it's 64-bit clean. How can you do that? Well, run it on alpha if you have access to one, or run it on HPUX, or things like that, and look carefully if you have source access. I'm pretty sure that something like Mozilla has tons of non-aligned accesses, right? It's okay you have the underlying trap access, but what's good about the Linux community is that you have source access, so please fix it, because one day we're going to disconnect the underlying trap handler. Yeah. The sooner the better. So there is a summary of the timeline of how we've developed that thing. So basically we started in February 98, and it took something like almost 6 months to get the tool chain up. At that point, David was working alone on this thing, so I want to give him some credit for doing what he did with this thing. And back in, I think in September of last year, we had basically the user level simulation hosted on Linux, so you could run simple test programs. And we really started the kernel work in October. And ever since, you can see that we've been adding things pretty quickly. And we're not done yet, but the key pieces are in place so that you can run actual applications. So to summarize some of the attributes, we're using EGCS 112 and GAS, whatever, 990404. We can run on the simulator the kernel or just the user-level applications. We're tracking the latest kernel release. It's not always easy because, especially in the 2.3, there things are evolving very quickly, and even sometimes the thing is completely broken. So you say you spend time trying to add your patch, but say, well, it doesn't work. Of course, the machine independent part is broken. So, and you have the other attributes. So in conclusion, I want to say that we will be ready. I'm pretty sure we'll be ready for the Merced launch sometime in mid-2000. And you can expect to see some distribution of Linux for IS64. I hope to see just the CD, not some terrible hoop that you have to go through. And this effort also proves that you can develop free software even though you have NDAs. It's not like it's completely closed. HP is doing it by itself and stuff like that. We're talking to other people and not just the HP, Intel, and so on, but people completely outside, like the CERN people. And so inside this firewall, we are just working in the open source manner, exchanging the patches and talking on mailing lists and stuff like that. So it's pretty much like a normal free software project. It may be hard to join, but still, as I pointed out before, you can probably help by making sure your software is clean. And also, if you write software, please write some tests to it, because it's hard to just, that's not because it compiles that it runs, and it's not because you run it once that it will always run. So it would be good to have some good tests to it, at least to capture some of the early errors, like the obvious ones. So I think I'm pretty much done here. I have some acknowledgement. I want to acknowledge Fred Lewis and Jean Gascon at Labs, who have been sponsoring our work, and also I think Michel Bonnard and SP Geneva, who has made possible the cooperation with CERN. And you can go to some, I would mention two websites where you have the HP Go Linux, where you have more or less the strategic point of view of HP on Linux. And if you follow, there is a, strangely enough, the pointer to our previous talks and paper are buried somewhere in this first URL. I think you have to follow like products or something, and you'll find David's paper from Linux Expo. And I think this paper is also going to move to this site. The other site of interest is the IS64 website from HP, where you can get some of the white paper press releases, and also you can get pointers to the instruction set manual. You can get to the HP version or the Intel version. The difference between the two, I let you guess what it is. Okay, so now on the demo. So I think it's worthwhile looking at the figure here to understand what's going on. So you're on the Linux x86 host, and basically you have running on top of that normal process, which is the instruction set simulator, and inside of it you have the kernel, which is the VM Linux kernel. And then on top of that you have the user commands that you run. And the devices that I mentioned, the serial, SCSI, and Ethernet, are just strapping to the simulator, and then the simulator goes through the host OS to get access to the I/O. So when the IS64 kernel does a SCSI read, basically it gets translated into a read on, let's say, SDA or SDB, whatever your file, because that's a file really, on the X2 file system, on the host, really is. For the Ethernet, you can, I'm not going to show that because I have only one machine, but basically the same thing. You go through the simulator and you say, read me the next frame, or you get interrupted and you say, oh, I got interrupted, give me the next frame, and you read it. So I think I'm done with the talk, so if you have questions before I move on to the demo, be glad to try and reply to them. I have no idea myself. I know they have machines. They have machines probably for the Unix market, and they probably have machines for the net server type of machine of hardware, I think. But I'm not sure. I'm not in this business. I'm at Labs, and well, you know, at HP, you're more disconnected somehow of what the product division are doing. Yeah. So I think WSY, the division that does the visualized graphics and all that stuff, has announced that they will have IS64-based machine in the future, and on their roadmap, clearly. And that, as you probably heard, they're moving to Linux, too. They're offering now IF32 Linux-based workstations as well as Win64. Yeah? Yes, the RPM bug got fixed last week. So RPM 302 has the bug fixed. For ping, I wrote a patch, but didn't have time to submit because ping is more, it's more work, because basically this code is from 1983. It's coming from some US Navy somewhere, and it's still using Red Hat 6. Because everybody likes it, or nobody spends the time trying to move things here. But it has to do with the time valve structure. Time valve structure on LP64 is not what it is on on LP32. So things needs to change here, and you don't want to do cast like that. So yeah, you have to be careful. Hopefully most of the key packages, big like Emacs and like the VIs and things, they're, apparently they're okay. They've been running, I've been run on many, many platforms before, so you hope that they're okay. Well, on my laptop, I would probably have to come back later tonight, but we are using, for the development, of course, we moved from the laptop, and we're using an HP Net server, you know, this nice rack mountable Net server, and we're, most of the development so far happened on the 400 megahertz Pentium 2. And it's clearly not enough, especially when you have two people trying to run the simulator on the same platform. So I think before I left for Ottawa, I got the upgrade to dual 500 Pentium 2 machines. So it's probably better now. I will see next week. So I think it's because it's basically CPU bound, this thing, because the simulator is like crazy going in the loop and looking and doing a lot of verification. It's never been optimized for speed. So it does many checks and all that. It's very CPU intensive. And of course, you don't want to swap. So, but these days, I think it's OK. You have minimum is 128 meg on the PCs. So. okay, so let's move to the demo. So it's slow, but my laptop is just a Pentium 1, 233, and MMX is not going to help me here. I'm not sure it helps. Let's see if I can run it here. So basically, I don't know if you can see here, you can see the VM Linux is the non-compressed kernel that you would get out of a normal compiler. You get a bootloader that simulates basically what a LILO would do. And you get SDN, SDB, which are two disk images. And if you look at them, maybe I can make it. Maybe. You see they are just two big files that are just a disk image. And that's pretty nice because if you use the loop device, you can, from this machine, you can access the file system that's on SDN, SDB, and you can just transfer files back and forth between the two. Because otherwise, you say, how do I populate this SDA with the good stuff? The loop device is very nice. And of course, you have the simulator. And I'll show you later a user mode simulation so that you can appreciate the speed difference. Anyway, let's do that before, I think, oops. I want to make huge fonts. So here you see 227. I broke my 237 last week. So it's booting now. So you see the usual boot screen where, yeah, the Bogomips, that's why you laugh. No. Don't count on it. It's not the real one. It's calculated. It's not a fake number, but it doesn't reflect what you would get on the real hardware, of course. You can see that you get the serial driver. You get the TCP/IP initialized. The kernel detects the two SCSI disks, SDN, SDB. And it's now freeing the memory used for initialization, and it's launching init 274. I don't know, maybe that 276 these days. I don't have networking. The Ethernet detection is turned off because I don't have another machine. The other thing is that we don't use Bash as the basic shell because it's too big and too slow, and we don't go through the whole RC scripts because it would take a long, long time. So we're still using our tiny shell that we developed back in January, and we have simplified version of the RC scripts. Basically, they do the really minimum. They activate the swap here, and you'll see that they mount like the dev PTS, they clean up mtab, and what they set the host name, and things like that. That's about it, because otherwise it would take forever, and that's not very good. It's already slow. But on a 400 megahertz, it takes like less than 20 seconds or something to boot, to go through the login prompt. Or less than that, yeah, I think. And the jobs thing is a tiny shell message so that you can see what's going on. It's like it's not stuck in the background with no messages. The X2FS warning is that we don't run E2FS CK in the script, so it's mounting something that has not been checked, and it's warning. Not too bad. Sometimes it's completely screwed up, you need to. And the nice thing is that you get out of this and you do an FSCK using the loop device, and you actually FSCK this SDF file system. We're almost there. It won't be too long. It's really nice when you get rlogind working, because as soon as you get inetd and stuff, then you can rlogin and you have some kind of a multi-user system. okay, this one is just configuring the loopback device, the loopback. On networking, I think inetd and things like that were straightforward. I think no problem. The thing is that sometimes it's hard to compile existing packages because the makefiles and the setup varies, and the quality of the package varies a lot. Sometimes the makefile is just, what are they doing? It's not just, what I would like is to be able to do RPM dash dash rebuild and get the final thing. Sometimes it clearly needs more and more work. And that's not because you get the binary that it runs. We don't have kernel modules, so we don't get the PAM authentication, which is apparently standard these days, so you can't just compile password and all that. So here we are. Good. So I have no password. And you know why. yeah, my laptop, I think, too. Need to upgrade my laptop, too. and so the next, I think the next library that we worked on was curses, because things like nice commands like top and things like that, they require curses, and I think we got curses to work. Is that true? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think we got some curses, so now you can have top, but still the libc still needs some debugging, as do the other packages. Yeah? Oh yeah, term cap. So here it's not the real shell, it's the tiny shell that we use. So but you get the prompt, and basically it's like the regular, even though it's a tiny shell, it has some nice features in it, like the path in the prompt and some control command line editing and things like that. Otherwise it's too painful. So where are we? You can cd, you can do ls, and most of the commands now are the actual coming out of the RPMs. It's not fake, the small ls and things like that. That's the real ls. Well, you have to remember that here the system just booted, so to get the data, it has to go through the IS64 buffer cache. Oh, it's not there. Then go through the SCSI stack, then trap to the simulator. The simulator then goes, oh, I need to read it from the file on the host. And then you do this again. We say it's in the buffer cache, blah, 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 and get it. The second time around, it's faster, of course, because it's in the IS64 buffer cache. Okay, so you get the... you get the LS, you get free, and here I think I'm simulating like 16 or 18 megabytes of memory. I think you saw that earlier. Get free, get mount. Of course, you get the good stuff in slash proc.
What is your
Hey, Steve, I was pretty sure you were going to ask me this question. There are two good things, and two things about it is that the kernel here I haven't modified since the instruction set has been disclosed. And since it's been disclosed, I can now print more stuff in the CPU info than I was able to do before. But it's still the old stuff, so you won't see many things. So you get this, you get the mount, of course. And you want to see the slash proc, oops. And you do ls, you get the normal stuff here. So that's one of the joy of working in this project is you have to be careful in what you expose, not expose. You have to go and think. So you get everything here. Maybe I can show you what partitions. Is that one working? Yeah. So I said that we had signals and more real shells and stuff, so I can try and show that to you. So I can run KSH, and that's the PDK KSH, I think. Then can run VI, I can run all the commands that you. But as long as the command doesn't require like dynamic. The dynamic loader, like password, the password command, the real one that is used out of this password package requires the PAM, and PAM requires some kind of dynamic loader. So there is another password hidden somewhere into this util Linux package. So that's the one we use here. So now we have kshell, and from kshell, that's the usual kshell, so we can run VI. So you were asking this, how long does it take to launch VI? I don't know.
Is this
VI
Vim?
Vim.
Everything is
statically linked. Well, maybe you can time this one and I can show you later. I can take the same binary and run it in user mode only, so I would just cut at the system call level. So that's much faster, of course.
In the bottom window, you have Vim, which is 7 megs. Is that the actual size?
Yes. It's not optimized, I think. I'm not even sure it's stripped.
And it's statically linked, too.
Sorry?
It's statically linked.
It's statically linked. With the GNU libc, not the micro libc, the real libc. That's the annoying thing. I need to fix that. It's some term info or something, but it's working. It has some built-in, you know. It's prepared to deal with that. So it's slow. So you don't want to do that too often, especially on the laptop, so it's just for you. So you get this Vim, which is the one coming directly. And that one was really straightforward. You just say configure and then make. So that's the one you get. Signals are working, so you can actually control Z. That works. Yes. So you get the job controls and things like that. Oops. Yeah, and the other thing that I mentioned was working is the ptrace support. So, oops. Well, maybe we can stay in. Oops. Yeah, it's TTY. The strace is working, so you can do an strace of /bin/ls. So it's using. That thing is no. And strace is big because it has all the strings and stuff. Yeah. But it works. It works. But that's nice to have to debug. But that's a fun program because it's a very good program if you're looking at a binary only and you try to figure out what's going on, like Netscape, what is it doing? Well, it's doing it. It's slow, but it's correct. where am I? Depends on where. If I'm in slash dev or something, it's going to take forever. I'm in slash? Okay. Okay, so that one is working too. And now, okay, so let me, I think I'll show you. Oh, PS, yeah. So why did I put the N? That's the question that you may be asking. Is N says, don't try to figure out the TTY name, because a PS is like, wow, it's looking at slash dev slash TTY like crazy. I say, well, it's going to take forever. So the N is just to say, put the numeric value of the TTY so it's slightly faster. Really? Yeah. So we have all the kernel threads working. And of course, the way we did that is that at first we got the basic components that would get us to start kernel. Then you start enabling like more VM, the interrupts and things like that. Then you add the context switching code. Then you add the system call entry and all of that to get you to user mode. And so at first we were context switching inside the kernel with the kernel threads, which are here, I think the KPIOD, KSWAPD, and that's the first one we got. So that thing is also working. So let me get out of here and show you user mode. Oops, yeah. Alt is a built-in in tiny shell. That's useful too. Okay, so now. But it's doing the real stuff. It's doing the sys reboot, the system call. Okay, so now you can do exactly the same thing. Take the simulator and say, run Vim. Oh, that's a VI. And it can do it in the console, in a separate console, or it can do it inside your current TTY. Hey, it's coming. Yes, here it is. So it's much faster, and of course, it's this, and it's getting the file from your current host. It's not looking into SDA anymore, it's looking from the real host here, so, and that's much faster. Another nice command that I can show you is the first web browser, right? These days you have to have a web browser if you don't have a web browser, you're not a system. useful system. If I can't read my man page from the web browser, I'm stuck. So you can get links also the same way, so you see it's much faster. And we have so most of the commands, if the coverage of the system call emulation is complete, you can run most of the commands. And you can even run a shell in user mode. So you can run bash or T-shell in user mode, and if you type ls, it's going to check, am I running the IS64 binary or the IF42 binary? And it dynamically adapts and says, oh, it's an IA64, so I need to run the simulator on it. If it's an IA32, it just goes and does fork exec, and you run it. And you come back, you're in this shell. Okay, that's. I think I'm done. So if you have more questions on this presentation.
Are you going to put your presentation on your webpage?
The paper is in the proceeding. It's also a technical report out of HP Labs. And so if you go to the external HP Labs website, you maybe, not today, but maybe next week or the week after, may be able to get it. I think it's something like 9983, the number. The paper, the presentation, I think I'm going to do just like we did for Linux Expo. Both are going to be also available from our personal website, also from the HP Go Linux somewhere. So, or you can also send me an email and I can send it to you. Okay. So if you have no more questions.
Which was hard, porting the compiler or porting the kernel?
Well, I did not do the compiler work, so it's hard to speak for someone else. But I think it's the good thing about doing the compiler is that it forces you to really understand the architecture in depth, because it has some very tricky stuff. And so you know all the pitfalls to avoid and all the problems and things like that. The kernel was surprisingly not too difficult, and I must say that the Linux kernel so far is very well organized in that, that the machine dependent and independent part are very well separated, and if you concentrate on this, it's not too difficult to get the port done quickly. And if you look at the timeline, you see that we started in October, and like in early January, we were already in user land. So I would say that if you look at the compiler, you say, well, it took 6 months to get the compiler up to speed. So it's a real piece of work, the compiler, and that's why I think we're glad that Cygnus is now on board and they have the expert in GCC, EGCA, so they can move quickly on that. And for the kernel, I think we got very lucky that David was part of this project. He started this project, so I would qualify him as a very good kernel architect. It takes a long time to understand the whole thing. People are most of the time in Linux are maybe specialized into one part, but some people who have the complete overview of how things are working in the compiler, the kernel, the C library, dynamic loader, there are very few people like that. So I think we can thank you for this. So it's not too difficult. I don't know how hard it's been for people from HPUX or Solaris or even Win64 to get their stuff up and running. But we had the chance that it's been ported many times already in various platforms, very different platforms. So there was already a good part of the work done. Any other question?
The IA64 is supposed to be backwards compatible with PA RISC.
No.
HP has said it's similar.
It's not. They're going to use. I think the point on that is that it's going to be backward compatible. Well, let's see. It's going to be backward compatible binary with IA32 user mode only. That's what's been disclosed. And for PA RISC, I think the idea is to use software emulation, dynamic translation.
Same as what they did for the classic.
Probably, yeah. So that's why if you look at the Intel, what they call ADAG, which maybe people have looked at that. Oops, I can show it to you, this one. This one. This one has a description of the IF32 emulation. This one. I don't know if you've seen that one. That one is publicly available. And it has somewhere buried here. Where is that? The IF32.
Chapter 6.
Yeah, somewhere. Oops. What's that? Chapter 6. Oh, IF32 execution here. Yes, here. So here they describe how they emulate and how they do the mapping of the registers and all of that. So it is expected that you'd be able to run IF32 binaries unmodified on IA64. And for PA RISC, I think it's dynamic translation, so software.
So do you foresee running IA32 Linux applications?
That's why I had on the slide what's involved, this yellow box called Linux x86 environment, which is this add-on that you have to provide to make sure that everything is working, the C libraries that are found and all of that. That's, for me, I don't care. I don't care about so much about IA32, but other people, if they can't get the IF32, IF64 port like Mozilla or something, they want to run it, they're going to take the IA32 binary and run it. And most of the application, I'm not sure I'm going to get my applics on my IA64 machine right away. Maybe never. So I may be stuck with the IF32 binary emulation. That's a possibility. And So that's why it's there. And people would like to see this thing up and running at launch date. So I think we're going to push for that too. Even though I don't want to do it myself. Some people are going to do it, I'm pretty sure. Okay, so do you have any other question on IS64 and the first part of the presentation? Because maybe it's brand new or...
You mentioned good reasons why Linux should be ported to IS64.
Right.
Could you summarize why HP wants to do it?
Because there are very few people who have access to this information. Back in N98, because we think it's good for, it's good if we can get it. It's good for IS64, it's good for HP, and it's good for me, because hey, I want to have it the first day. I don't want to be stuck for, and you see, we have been putting a lot of effort doing this full time for over a year now, and it's not done, so it's a lot of effort. It doesn't happen in one day. So the sooner we start, the better are the chances that we get something good.
What about HPUX?
What about HPUX? You're going to get it on IS64 also. People are working on that. That's clear. You're going to get Solaris, Win64, whatever IRIX or whatever Novell is up to. And everybody's going to move to that. Many people have endorsed this architecture, so it means that they're working on making the software run on that. So it's going to happen no matter what. So any other questions? And the other nice thing about that is maybe that I didn't mention is the fact that working with the simulator is very good, because you don't want to bring up an OS on the real hardware, because it's a pain to debug when you don't even have the printf and all that working. So working with the simulator at first, say, oh no, it's going to be slow, but it turned out to be really good to debug the low-level stuff, because when something went wrong, you could of course put debug printf and all that or panics, but you could also debug the simulator. One thing you can do is run GDB on the simulator and figure out, oh, it's doing this instruction. Why? What's the status? What's in this TLB? What's in the interruption and all that stuff? So having done that, I think before doing another port, I would look at the availability of a simulator. And it's much, much better. And the speed is not an issue at the beginning. I can't disclose that, so yeah, I didn't bring it, so but it's been publicly announced that what Mercedes stepped out now, like a week or two ago.
Has anybody tried to think of how to put a debugger on this stuff, especially with multi-pipeline execution?
Oh, you mean GDB? Or any debugger? Well, it has to be done. It's not there yet, but it's clearly a required feature, right?
Yeah, but just trying to figure out what register your variable is in now, or was in, looks like it's going to be really tough.
Well, look, we got the strace working, and the thing like that, you need to figure out where is my register really in memory when this context is 7 or that.
Because
so. Oh, you mean with the speculation and stuff?
In the speculation stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So. No matter how you look at it, they're going to be a performance hit. If you want to eliminate those, some special tools are going to be needed.
Oh, yeah, but I don't want to be working on those. I'm not an expert in GDB, so I left it. I leave it to people who know, and maybe they have an idea how to do it. It's possible, otherwise. No, I'm pretty sure that... Well, so far we haven't run into those problems because the compiler doesn't use speculation. But the assembly code that we wrote, at least the very few routines, we're trying to use the speculation. So you have to be careful there. But as soon as you see the speculation and stuff everywhere, then yes, that's good, because in some you exercise more code and see, oh, I didn't save that thing, or what's going on in the NAT bits and things, and oh, I missed one. So in some sense, that's going to be more fun. And okay, no more questions. So thank you for coming, and we hope to keep you informed of the progress, even though all the NDAs and stuff are still there. So I think if we're going to talk about this some more in the next few months as we make progress and as more information gets disclosed, we can open up the kernel a little bit more. Okay. Thank you.